It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, everyone from the New York Times to Vogue is talking about how big butts are a trend. But can body parts really be a trend? And are large behinds anything new?
Well, first we're taking a look at a new report on campaign ad spending in Wisconsin.
It's a big election year, but the Nonpartisan Center for Public Integrity just released a report showing TV campaign ad spending is down significantly from the last race for governor in Wisconsin.
Here to talk about this new report and what it could mean for our governor's race is Barry Burton. He's a professor of political science at UW-Madison. Barry, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what exactly does report tell us about campaign ad spending in Wisconsin during this election cycle?
Well, the report says that compared to 4 years ago during the 2010 campaign, the number of ads is down pretty sharply and the amount of spending is down pretty sharply. Both of those are about half of where they were at this time in 2010.
That seems surprising. So how much lower is TV ad spending than it was in 2010?
Well, it looks like through the first week of September, about $5.5 million has been spent on television ads, and that compares to about $11.5 million that was spent back in 2010. So it's a pretty noticeable drop.
So what are the theories about why this is happening, that the TV ads are not spending as much this season?
Well, I think it's a really complicated story. So there's not a single explanation. There are a number of races around the country where ad money is also down, and so it's not entirely a Wisconsin story. Some of it has to do with the fact that in 2010, there was also a U.S. Senate race on the ballot, and that had a pretty hotly contested primary in which there was a governor's race for the primary and also a Senate race for the primary, and those drew money in a way that this governor's race has not so far. There was not a hot primary this time around and not a Senate race at all. So part of it is just a difference in what was on the ballot and how many candidates were running.
Does this represent, do you think, larger trends about, you know, maybe candidates funneling their money toward, you know, things other than TV ads?
Yeah, I think there are a few things happening. One may be that candidates are putting their money elsewhere. It may be in field operations, trying to get volunteers and paid campaign workers to go door to door. Research has shown that that's a much more effective way to persuade people to come to your side and to mobilize people who are already your supporters. It might also be that money is being spent on online activities or other things that aren't captured by TV advertising itself.
Any idea how the ad money for TV ads compares to spending during the 2012 recall elections? Those are more recent in terms of statewide elections.
Well, I'm not sure that we'll ever reach the records that were set in the 2012 recall. There was something like $80 million spent in that governor's race. That was more than double what was spent in the 2010 governor's race. Right now, it's difficult to see us even getting to the level of the 2010 race. And I should just point out, there was about $37 million spent in that 2010 race. At this time, 4 years ago, only $11 million had been spent. So there was another $20 or $25 million pumped into the campaign just in the last 45 to 60 days. So we should expect a real ramping up here over this last month of the campaign.
Do we have any idea whether this echoes national trends, that maybe candidates are spending their money elsewhere nationally?
It does seem to be happening elsewhere as well. It's not just a Wisconsin story. There are certainly races that are getting a lot of spending. There were a few governor's races in states like Pennsylvania and Florida where there were just millions of dollars being spent by the campaigns. And there are some really hotly contested Senate races in places like Kentucky where there's an awful lot of spending going on. So it's possible that there are some donors who have been putting their money strategically into these states where the races are really hard fought. And at least for a while, it looked like Wisconsin was not going to be competitive. Walker was ahead in the polls until about July. And I think at that point, people began to believe that this race was tightening up and was going to be a close one. And I think that has started to bring some money back into Wisconsin from some other states.
We had a comment on Facebook from Jen who said, I think Walker spent his money spamming YouTube with ads. Every single video has ads. Has there been, do you think, evidence that internet spending is a huge part of where candidates are leaning?
I don't know if I would say huge just yet, but there has been a shift in campaign spending toward online media rather than traditional television. Traditional TV is still the dominant way that candidates reach out to voters. But, you know, Wisconsin is in a different place than it was 5 or 10 years ago in terms of the number of people who are already committed to one side or the other. Very few undecided voters. So spending money on media to try to persuade people is probably going to be less effective, and really running ads or emails or the sponsored YouTube clips, whatever it would be, to your supporters, where you really just need to get them out, not convince them that your side is right. That is increasingly looking like a smart strategy.
And what about voter fatigue? You know, here in Wisconsin, we've been through a lot. You know, 2012 isn't that long ago when we had, you know, our last big ad campaigns. Is there evidence that maybe there's just, you know, fatigue from voters and candidates? Maybe they just want to soft pedal it this election.
I don't think the campaigns have any courtesy when it comes to being nice to voters. They're really just trying to figure out how to spend dollars wisely and how to raise as much as they'll need, maybe more than they'll need. Why the spending is a little light this year is just a little bit of a mystery. I've offered a few explanations, but I think we still don't quite have a handle on why there have just been fewer ads this time around. Voters should be thankful for the time being, but be warned, it's going to be coming back here shortly.
Well, we've also got people unplugging from cable in greater numbers, watching their content on Netflix, Hulu, other sources, so they're not, you know, maybe receiving ads in traditional ways. I suppose that could be something that we should be thinking about, too.
It is easier today to avoid political news and avoid the ads that are often associated with it. It turns out that the people who do that, who are unplugging or watching media in non-traditional ways, are also less likely to be active voters. If you look at where TV advertising is placed, it's often around local news. It's around game shows like Wheel of Fortune. It's aimed at demographics where there are regular voters who are going to be affected by those ads. So certainly the campaigns are aware of this, and it just becomes more difficult for them to try to reach people who are outside the traditional ways of viewing media.
So you've said that we can expect to see the ads coming back as we get closer and closer to Election Day. Do you think we're going to reach levels of 2010 spending?
It's possible. We're behind the trend to reach that level, but it could happen. What was different in 2010 is there were more outside groups involved in the spending. That was also true in the recall year in the summer of 2012. This year so far, there's really been very little spending by outside groups. Most of the $5.5 million that's been spent in the governor's race has been the campaigns of Scott Walker and Mary Burke. Very little from groups like Emily's List and the Republican Governors Association. The NRA has recently come into the state running ads. But I think those groups are likely to step up their bids and put more money into the state, as this looks like really a national race to watch.
Well, Barry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome. It was good speaking with you.
We've been speaking with Barry Burden, professor of political science at UW-Madison. He was with us to talk about a new report showing a drop in spending on TV campaign ads.
Big, big booty, but you got a big booty. Oh. Big, big booty, but you got a big booty.
Big,
big.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Can a body part be a trend? Hemlines rise and fall, jeans flare out and taper in, but how about actual parts of your body?
If you read some of the country's biggest mainstream trend commentators, it appears that big butts have actually become a trend. Everyone from the New York Times to Vanity Fair to Vogue has done a feature on big booties, with Vogue saying we're officially in the era of the big booty.
Songs and music videos by some of the most popular artists out there have also added to the conversation. Names like Beyonce, Nicki Minaj, and Jennifer Lopez have lately all featured music and moves that emphasize the butt, like the song we just heard by J-Lo called Booty.
But should we see bodies in this light, and is the conversation ignoring what some commentators are pointing out, that big behinds have been celebrated in Latino and African American communities for a long time? Kara Brown joins us now. She's a staff writer at Jezebel. Kara, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you.
So according to Vogue, big butts are officially in style, and it's kind of interesting to say about a body part that everybody has. What do you think? Can big booties be a fashion trend?
You know, I think it's difficult to describe a body part as a trend. You know, I think you can say that perhaps this new focus in the mainstream pop culture sphere, which is sort of understood to largely be a white audience, it might be a trend in that way. But something that that's a part of your body and isn't going anywhere when the trend does or does not die, you know, it's hard for me to use that word in this instance.
Well, let's lay out the evidence, at least as Vogue sees it. What is the evidence that we're in a new era where big butts are what everybody wants?
They're basically arguing that there are a lot of female artists right now who are drawing attention to have, you know, to their butts, that having a big butt now is something that a lot more women are looking to achieve. They point to Jen Seltzer, who is a Instagram star. She's sort of a fitness model, and she has a very round, prominent booty. And they're basically saying that now this is something that women want, which, you know, perhaps there are certain women who now want it. But like you said earlier, in, you know, Latino and African-American cultures, this is a body part that we've celebrated. And, you know, having a big butt was always something that was considered beautiful and was something that, you know, was envied.
And by the way, as a side note to that, apparently everyone now needs to know the word Belfie, short for butt selfie.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
I haven't taken one yet. I hope never to take one, but I guess they're out there.
You and me both.
Well, what do you make of the fact that, you know, you've got Vogue, usually features waif-like women, models like Kate Moss in their magazine, that they're trying to jump on top of this big booty trend? Is this a fact trying to get out ahead of a story that's already broken, in effect?
I mean, I guess, you know, that's definitely one way to look at it. I think that they have, I think what really happened is they have the Kim Kardashians and the Jen Seltzers, and I think that they've found women that they are more comfortable putting in their magazines who have this figure, who have this shape, and to them, that makes it a thing now, because they could have had, I mean, just so many women of color, you know, who, you know, actresses, singers, just all types of women who had this figure and celebrated this figure for so long. But basically now that white girls have kind of discovered it or decided that having a big butt is actually kind of cool, you know, now they have women that I think that they prefer to put in their magazine.
And we're going to listen to a track that goes back a ways, maybe credited with launching a long time ago some of the new feelings about butts. This is Jennifer Lopez. I like big butts and I cannot lie. You other brothers can't deny. Now when a girl walks in with an itty bitty. Oh, it's a different one. It's called Got Back, another butt classic.
Baby Got Back,
and by
yeah.
the way, there's quite a genre around butt songs. There's also the bass song, which is out right now. This one's by Sir Mix-a-Lot. And, you know, you were talking about race before, and the Vogue piece about big butts was pretty dainty about race. They didn't use the word black or African-American. And they were talking about, you know, Nicki Minaj, Rihanna. But do you see this because of this, you know, what you're describing? Is it essentially a case of cultural appropriation?
You know, I think in some way it can be. I think the main issue for me is that, you know, if you want to talk about big butts, and if Vogue wants to say that, hey, we weren't really down with them before, but now we've decided this is something we like, then cool, that's fine. But what I have a problem with is erasing women of color from that narrative. So yes, they do mention Rihanna, and they do mention Nicki Minaj and Beyonce, and we all know that they're black women, but that completely misses the fact that in these cultures, this was a desirable trait for a very long time. So it's not just that, oh, look, we have Beyonce now and she has a big butt, but she was proud of her figure and she has been. And, you know, you can go back to old interviews of Beyonce talking about being curvy and loving her body because she grew up in a culture where that was something to be admired. So the fact that, you know, they don't mention women of color specifically is what I have an issue with, because it's just erasing us from discussions about beauty and erasing us as examples of beautiful women, really.
Well, when a trend or an idea goes mainstream or gets co-opted, depending on your point of view, what happens to the community that, you know, sort of birthed the idea?
I think now you have a lot of people in these communities that are looking at this kind of with a little bit of side eye, like, okay, cool, they just figured it out. And the thing is, now it's profitable, right? So Jen Seltzer is making a lot of money off her body when there are so many other black and brown women who were fitness instructors and did a lot of squats and had the exact same sort of brand that Jen Seltzer is peddling, but they weren't being paid attention to. And I think you see now, you know, Nicki Minaj coming out with a song called Anaconda and Jennifer Lopez with Booty. You know, this is not like them just looking down and realizing, oh, hey, I have a big butt. This is something cool. They just realize that it's become profitable for them to sing about it and really call attention to it.
You know, you talked about there being sort of a white ideal earlier, and I think a lot of women have felt like they needed to fit into that ideal that you see in fashion magazines. Women have been straightening their hair for a long time and dieting. You know, does this change the way that, you know, women of color get talked about in the conversation about beauty?
You know, I would hope that if anything, it widens the picture of what we see as beautiful. You know, this isn't to say that having a big butt makes you more beautiful than not, or that being really thin is less beautiful than being curvy. You know, this is about women having different body types because that's just how, you know, we do, and women look different, and sort of understanding that beauty can look a lot of different ways. And I think that's what I would hope would be the takeaway from conversations like this. Not that, oh, I hope now everyone, you know, is out doing squats and wants a big butt, but that they're saying, okay, this is beautiful, and so is this, and so is this. And I think necessarily widening that view, you end up seeing more women of color.
And do you think it's going to do that? Are we going to be more accepting? Or is this, you know, just a blip on the radar for Vogue, just a trend that they're pointing to and wanting to be part of, and then, you know, next season, mm-hmm. butts are out again?
You know, for something like Vogue and the New York Times, Vogue is trends, and reporting on trends is pretty much their entire approach. That's what they do. So I think it would be naive for me to think that now Vogue is going to start hiring models with curvier figures and things like that. I think that they are kind of jumping on something that is popular right now and that very popular artists are talking about. So I would hope that maybe it could, you know, maybe Vogue will start featuring curvier models and things like that, and designers will start designing for wider hips and a bigger butt. But I don't, unfortunately, have a ton of faith in that. But, you know, you never know.
Are there things that you think women of color would like to see when it comes to being included in the cultural conversation about what beauty is?
Yeah, I mean, I think we would like to be included. For example, the LA Times wrote an article about cornrows about a week ago, and they didn't mention any black women. And again, it's just, you can't erase us from this. I think we just want to be included, and I think that we want credit for the same things that, for doing the things that white women will do also. You know, if it's beautiful on them, it's beautiful on us as well.
Now, you wrote this piece in Jezebel about butts, saying, hey, you know, butts have been around for a long time. You know, get with it, Vogue. What kind of response did it get?
I get really great responses from a lot of women of color who are noticing the same thing. You know, there are a lot of people who will say, you know, you don't get to own a body type. You can't say that having a big butt is only a black thing. And I've never said that. What I've said is that it's something that was celebrated in these cultures, and I really don't think it has been celebrated in this larger mainstream culture the way it has been for other communities. So a lot of people don't like when I say that, but I'm not in any way attributing this one quality to only black people or to all black women.
Anything you want to say there to encourage people to accept their booties, no matter what size, is no matter what Vogue says as we go forward?
Yeah, well, Vogue should not be your standard of what is and isn't beautiful, I would say. That comes from you.
All right, Kara, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Kara Brown, staff writer at Jezebel, talking about the cultural conversation going on right now about being in the so-called era of the big booty.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later, we'll kick off our series of candidate forums for the November elections. Today, we'll meet the candidates running for Attorney General of Wisconsin.
First, we take a look at the history of generic drugs in the United States. These days, generic versions of popular drugs are all over the place. But when you take a closer look at how generic drugs became so popular, things are more complicated than they seem.
Jeremy Green is with us. He's Associate Professor of Medicine and the History of Medicine at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. He's also the author of Generic, The Unbranding of Modern Medicine. Jeremy, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much, Veronica. It's a pleasure to be here.
So as we said, it seems like generic drugs are everywhere today, but their popularity is still relatively new. Can you give us a sense how long ago they became so big in the healthcare market?
Well, what shocked me as a historian of 20th century medicine is how recent the generic drug industry is. If you look back in the 1960s, you know, beginning of the decade, fewer than 10% of all prescriptions are filled generically in the pharmacy. And there's even a lot of debate about whether there even is such a thing as a generic drug. There's no companies that call themselves generic drug companies in 1960. By the year 2010, more than 80% of all prescriptions filled in the United States are filled generically. And the generic drug industry is really a major, one of the dominant forces in the drug market worldwide at this point.
And in the introduction of your book, you've got two stories, one of a former FDA official and one of a scientist looking for differences between generic and name brand versions of some thyroid medications. I wonder if you could tell us about those.
Sure. It's something I learned along the course of doing research for this book, that there are a number of really human stories, many tragedies involved in both sides of the problem of generics. And when I say both sides of the problem, I mean the question of whether generics are really the same as brand name drugs, and any attempt to call them different has been a form of marketing smokescreen that prevents people from having access at affordable cost to medicines they need. Or on the other hand, whether generic drugs are not the same, and actually attempts to call them the same is a artificial stamp of government or insurance-based similarity or exchange, which produces cost effectiveness but at risk to human life. And I begin the book with two specific stories. One is of a gentleman named Marvin Seif, who I see as a real tragic figure. He was a career FDA staffer. He was the first person to be ahead of the FDA's division of generic drugs when that division opened up in the early 1970s. And, you know, if you look all along, Seif pops up here and there in different points of the book. He was an early champion of the generic drug industry. He really believed that generic drugs were a way of taking the problem of excess pharmaceutical promotion out of medicine and producing higher value, more accessible medicine. But he becomes involved in a scandal in the late 1980s and early 90s that many within the FDA now remember as the worst scandal to shake the FDA in its entire history. And it goes something like this. Generic companies begin complaining to Congressman John Dingell of Michigan, who's heading the Congress Oversight Committee, that they believe that applications by some generic drug companies to the FDA are getting streamlined and getting passed really quickly, and that applications from other generic drug companies are taking forever. And an investigation begins turning up materials by finding incriminating documents in the trash cans of FDA regulators. There's a real cloak and dagger story here involving FDA regulators. Turns out that there's manila envelopes stuffed full of thousands of dollars of cash. They're being left on desks or in bathrooms in the Park Lawn office building in Rockville, Maryland. And what's happening is some generic companies are paying regulators to lose the applications of other companies. And there's a story of bribe and graft that emerges. And as part of it, it turns out that even though all generic drug manufacturers need to prove is that their drugs are the same as the brand name drug, they don't have to prove efficacy and safety, that some companies couldn't even do that, and they were outsourcing that material. And one of the things that turns up, and, you know, stop me if I'm going into too much detail on this story.
Oh, go ahead.
One of the things that they turn up is there's a company here in Baltimore called Pharmakinetics that does these studies. It's a study called bioequivalence, showing that not only that a generic drug has the same chemical as the brand name drug, but that it's absorbed into the
into the body of human volunteers at the same rate that it actually gets to where it needs to go. And so this company is doing similarity tests for generic firms. One of the companies that comes up in the inquest, Bolar, turns out that it had submitted two samples for a test of bioequivalence to show that its generic version of the Sandoz tranquilizer Melril worked the same. And when they looked at these two samples, one was supposed to be Bolar's, the other was supposed to be Sandoz's, they found that actually, if you looked really closely, the Sandoz drug was a circle and had a Superman-like S with a triangle, which was Sandoz's logo. And the Bolar version was the same shape, except it had no S. But if they looked closely under a microscope, they could find traces of that S, so that Bolar had actually basically just taken the original brand name drug, sandpapered off the logo, and sent it into the lab claiming it was their own.
Wow. So this is interesting because this is a big question for people who take generic medications. Are they really the same? And I wonder where you got with that question. How similar do they have to be in terms of chemical composition and in terms of how they work in the body?
Well, it's a fascinating question. And, you know, I just want to say at the outset that as a physician, I prescribe generic drugs regularly in my practice. As a patient myself, and as a parent, I both consume generic drugs myself and offer them to my family when they're sick. But that doesn't mean that generic drugs are identical to brand name drugs. And, you know, in a sense, one of the problems that emerged in the story of Marvin Seif, and one of the reasons he winds up going to prison, is that he didn't realize that his trust in this generic industry, which he believed to be in some ways an outgrowth of merely a virtuous form of public policy, could actually lead to shortcuts and graft. So one of the questions we have today, the FDA has reformed quite a bit since that scandal, but what are the standards that we have to give us confidence that these things are the same? And I can list a few of them just to help listeners think about what it's like in the present day. I mean, generic drugs are supposed to be they're supposed to have the same active ingredients as the innovator drug, although inactive ingredients can vary. And we can talk more later about what it means to think of something as an inactive ingredient. They're identical in strength and dosage form and in route of administration. They're supposed to be used for the same purposes. They're supposed to be bioequivalent, the science of absorption that we talked about before. And they're supposed to meet the same batch requirements for identity, strength, purity, and quality. And they're also supposed to follow what the FDA calls good manufacturing practice regulations, meaning not only is that test batch supposed to be the same, but the something about the way the company produces its products should give you confidence that one batch is the same as another batch, that they keep up those good practices throughout. Now, one of the things we can talk about when we look at this is realizing that generic drugs are not identical. There's no claim that they're identical to brand name drugs. They're supposed to be similar. They're supposed to be same in the ways that we think matter. But there's a lot that goes on in the science and politics of what matters in drugs. And it's much more complicated than first appears.
So whose job is it then to vet whether or not the medication you're taking is the one that's most effective for whatever your health concern is, whether you should be taking the brand name drug or the generic drug? Now, does that burden fall to your doctor or is that the pharmacist's job?
Well, at this point in time, Veronica, most state legislatures have decided that therapeutically equivalent drugs, as deemed by the FDA, can be substituted at the pharmacy by a pharmacist. These substitutions can happen based on insurance programs, or they can merely happen based on the practice of pharmacy. What I would suggest, though, is that question you're asking right now: who gets to decide whether you get a brand name or a generic version? Is a live question that changes at different points in time over the 20th century. And in the beginning of the story of this book, the question is really unambiguous. It's the physician who decides. And there had been a wave of anti-substitution laws that had been passed in almost all 50 states, which made it illegal for a pharmacist to give a patient a generic version instead of a brand name version. This begins to change in the late 60s and the 1970s, and by the mid-1980s, all of those laws have been reversed and replaced by substitution laws, which actually mandate, in many cases, force pharmacists to give a generic version instead of a brand name version. And that historical change is part of a radical transformation in the nature of the doctor-patient relationship and how we look at health consumerism in America.
We're talking right now with Jeremy Green from the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine about his new book. It's called Generic, The Unbranding of Modern Medicine.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think about generic medications? What do you want to know about them? How do you think non-brand name medicines have changed the healthcare industry here in the United States? Do you take generic drugs, and have you ever had to take something that was maybe slightly different than what was prescribed, possibly for insurance reasons? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email talk@WPR.org.
We'll continue the conversation and get to your calls in a minute. Right now, here's a few headlines with Kristen Durst from WPR News.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're picking up our discussion about the history of generic drugs with Johns Hopkins Professor Jeremy Green.
And you can join the conversation. Do you take generic drugs? Why do you use them? Or do you want to stick with the brand name in some cases? What do you think about these non-brand name prescription medications? Have you seen them change healthcare in the United States? Maybe if you work in the business and you have questions about generic drugs or the industry or their history. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org.
And we go to our phones right now. We've got Kate on the line in Madison. Hi, Kate.
Hi. A couple things. My own experience has been that my insurance company won't pay for the brand name. And so in some cases I've had the choice of was I going to pay for it out of pocket, which is quite expensive, or go with the generic. I also have been told that, for seizure control, that many neurologists have had problems with using generics, that they find the brand name is, more effective, and that the generic has caused some problems. And the other thing that I've been told, and I'd like your guests to comment, is that generics are allowed to be within a certain percentage of brand names, so let's say between 90 and 110% or something like that, and that they're allowed to be in a range and they don't have to be 100%.
Gotcha. Got the gist of your question there, Kate. And yeah, let's talk about that, Jeremy. For one thing, I want to start with her her question about, you know, sometimes it seems as though the brand name works better, but someone, the insurance company perhaps, the doctor wants to prescribe generic, and that's what the consumer has to get. How is a consumer to navigate those waters?
So these are really important questions, and they're really hard to resolve immediately. So every consumer of a prescription drug is an N of one. And if we get back to the question about, say, what's an inactive ingredient, well, it may well be that the starches, the binders, the fillers, the parts of the pill that are not the molecule that is advertised are not important to most people. But if you have an allergy to one of those compounds, and any human person can be allergic to any number of different things in very, very idiosyncratic ways, there's always the chance for any individual person that this generic drug, although similar to the brand name drug in a general population, may be slightly different for them. At the same time, there's also the possibility, we now know that the placebo effect actually produces substantial difference in the effectiveness of medication, not in their efficacy, not in how they work in the clinical trial, but in how they work in real life. And so if someone believes that their medication has shifted and they see that the color of the pill has changed and they're worried that they're getting substandard medication, that product, in it, that process in and of itself can actually produce a form of difference.
Right. I mean, people are status seeking in general. And, you know, when we hear off brand, I don't think sometimes we react the same way as we would to something that was the one that cost more money.
It is a great point, Veronica. And one of the reasons I became so fascinated in this project is that researching the history of the generic is a way of researching what is the value of the brand. We can talk about this in terms of material differences and whether there is a difference in whether the chemical is bioavailable. But if all of that is the same, is there some other value of the brand that just takes on its own value? And I think in American medicine, there are many reasons to think that we have learned to value medicines by brand names in ways that makes it hard for us to then accept those chemicals in equivalent form later on.
Let's take another call here. We have Jeannie with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Jeannie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Two comments. One, from the perspective of the prescriber, I'm an eye doctor, and we are incredibly frustrated that there's many drugs that we used to prescribe routinely that are no longer on people's formularies, including generics. And when you prescribe the generic, sometimes it's $300, and it used to be $50. So that's been very frustrating. Many of the prices have been going up even on the generics. Number two, my second comment is, as a consumer, I've been on a popular blood pressure pill for years. It recently went generic. I started taking it, started getting headaches, took my blood pressure. Sure enough, my blood pressure had shot up, went back to the name brand, and it went back down. So, you know, that was my experience I take other drugs that are generics that are fine, but this particular one was not working, and had I not been on top of it, it could have had some serious consequences.
Okay, thanks a lot for your comments there, Jeannie. And what do you think about her comments, Jeremy?
So these are both very important points. I'd like to respond to both of them. Let me take the second one first. Here you're getting at this distinction, I would say, between reason and rationality. So the FDA works in rationality. It accumulates the data it can from populations and makes decisions about comparability based on that. That's really based on a population level. At the same time, as an individual, if you notice that your circumstances are materially different in a way that coincide with you taking this drug and that go away when you shift back to the normal drug, it's hard to know whether that was a placebo effect or something else. It doesn't sound like a placebo effect, but it's hard to know. But at the same time, you have to reason with that. And as an individual, you have to work with that and understand that your priorities wind up being different in that case from the bureaucratic structure of your insurer or of the FDA. And physicians are oftentimes in a bind here because, on the one hand, we are advocates to our patients on an individual basis as a fiduciary relation. On the other hand, we want to help produce cost-effective medicine when possible and not let our patients get fleeced. So this is this tension, I would say, between the individual reason and the more bureaucratic rationality, and generic drugs are suspended between those two. To take a second to your first question, because it is such an important question, I think your point illustrates some of the problems that we are now facing, given that we have embraced the generic drug market as a private sector solution to the public health problem of affordable access, right? We've tended to naturalize the generic drug as a sort of second life of a drug. The first life is a patent-protected stage when a new drug can be available at very high prices through a monopoly through its innovator. The belief then is that recoup of investment from the innovative company is made up for by the time the patent ends, and as soon as the patent ends, then generic competition will swoop in, drive the price down, and actually make medications more affordable and available. And the subtitle of my book is Generic, the Unbranding of Modern Medicine. It illustrates what happens in that process. And yet there's this process of rebranding of medicines that take place as well. Medicines that were generically available by many competitors with a low price that are now only available from one at a very high price. So this private sector solution can fail. One example is doxycycline, which is an old antibiotic, which in my training in internal medicine residency was often offered to us as a forgotten but very reasonable, older, generically available, cheap drug available at pennies a pill. And it now costs about $150 to get a supply because it's only available from one manufacturer. So we have these holes in the generic market, these ways in which that promise begins to break down that really need to be studied very closely.
And let's go next to Sarah, who joins us from Dubuque. Hi, Sarah.
Yes, hi. My question is do the excipients or fillers vary enough between the generic and name brand drugs to make a difference in their performance on the biochemical level?
Okay, good question, Sarah. What about that?
So this, again, gets at this question about what is the science of similarity. If the regulatory structure, if the scientific protocols the FDA use don't mandate equivalence or can't mandate absolute equivalence, as in the 100% concept that an earlier caller mentioned, how do we know what matters? And as a historian as well as a physician, I have to insist that how we know what matters changes over time when the sciences of similarity that we believe to be sufficient to guarantee therapeutic equivalence break down and show us that something we thought was unimportant or inert can actually be important. And there are many different places along the way in the last half century that unknown unknowns, things that we, and I would say we, I mean the entire scientific regulatory medical collective didn't recognize to actually be important forms of difference became evident as important forms of difference. And in a way, your question about, well, what if an excipient matters? Well, as soon as an excipient matters, the FDA then has to regulate it. But up till the point that nobody knows it matters, there's this question always that lurks within generic drugs of, are there unknown differences that we are not yet knowledgeable enough to attend to?
Well, as a physician and someone who studied this, what should consumers know to take care of themselves when they're looking at generic drugs or brand name drugs?
Well, I would encourage listeners to have a broad sense that the FDA is working very hard to ensure the therapeutic equivalence of generic and brand name drugs, and that those cost savings that occur when multiple generic competitors compete to produce an effective medicine at a lower price is really important to actually having a functional healthcare system. At the same time, we are all an N of one, and when there is a problem with a specific medication, I think a patient really needs to work with their physician to try to understand whether they happen to be an exception. And even though there are many bureaucratic structures that help incent generic substitution, from legal structures to economic structures to the nature of insurance reimbursement, a health provider always has a fiduciary responsibility to their individual patient to try and advocate for them if they are exceptional, and if for some reason what works for the general public is not working for them.
Great. Well, we're going to leave it there. Jeremy, thank you so much for joining us and talking about this today.
Thank you, Veronica. It's been a pleasure.
We've been speaking with Jeremy Green, Associate Professor of Medicine and the History of Medicine at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. He's also the author of the new book. It's called Generic: The Unbranding of Modern Medicine.